trees of Mamre, while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. And Abraham looked up, and he saw three men standing nearby. And when he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, "If I found favor in your eyes, my lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under this tree. Let me go get something to eat, so you can be refreshed, and then go on your way, now that you have come to your servant." "Very well," they answered. "Do as you say." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah, and he said, "Quick, get three seahs of fine flour and knead it and bake some bread." Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice, tender calf, and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. Verse 8, then he brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While they ate, he stood near them under a tree.
All right, before we point out key places in this passage, just to recap, our recording device has made it. So we're talking about Sukkot and hospitality, and that has led us to Abraham, the father of hospitality, among other things. We just read from Genesis 18, the first 8 verses. Okay, so go for it. What's the first thing that strikes you about Abraham in this section?
It's like he's waiting for visitors.
Okay, he's waiting for visitors. He's sitting out at the entrance of his tent. And the oaks of Mamre, some people have interpreted that it's at a crossroads. And so he's just waiting to invite somebody inside. And what's his first action when he sees three men standing near him? Then what?
He ran
from the door of his tent to meet them. Okay, let me ask you, in this culture, is this typical behavior?
In this culture?
I could say in any culture. When you see three strangers walking by.
Three strange men.
What do you do?
Let them walk by.
You let them walk by.
Check the door.
You may, if they ask you for something, if you're a nice person, you may offer them water. We think that would be really going out of our way today. How many of us would run up to them?
Even if you're dying of curiosity, you don't run up. Kids run up and betray their curiosity.
It's not distinguished for a man, especially wearing a dress like Abraham was, to run. It's not seen as
exactly. I'm reminded of the prodigal son, right? Yeah. When he comes back and his father runs to him, how atypical that would be. Instead, you know, if you were thinking about how you appear, you would, you know, your dignity would force you to stand still and wait for the person to come nearer to you. But Abraham runs to the door of the tent to meet them. Sorry, from the door of the tent to meet them. And he bows down to the ground. Okay, again, a greeting, but a greeting showing respect.
Exaggerated,
because he doesn't know who these people are. They could be good, they could be bad, they could be mediocre, they could be richer than him.
That's not an ordinary greeting. To bow down.
It's not an ordinary greeting if you presume that the person is your equal. If you presume that the person is above you, you would bow down. That is very standard.
Princes,
kings, dignitaries. Similar in today's world, if a government official came or a pop star, I don't know what, people would act differently when they're meeting them than you would just meeting someone you just assume is like yourself or the same social status.
Sharon, in Hebrew it's singular, it says Adoni. And so was he kind of suspected that there was one important person there?
Or you may be turning to one of them. Yeah, there are traditions that link this story with right afterwards when God turns and talks to him.
One stood out among the three. He was like,
maybe one stood out among the three. And that's an interesting point we could kind of follow off, but we're going to keep in the bigger picture. So we have him bowing down to greet them. Okay, so Abraham's giving the benefit of the doubt, not knowing who these people are, assuming that they are better than him. Which, what does that remind us of? Or what? I'll tell you what it reminds me of. When Jesus washed the disciples' feet, he was taking on a posture that is implying that the disciples are better than him, even though we know clearly they're not. But it's that same attitude. So here Abraham, the total strangers, and he's bowing down to them, implying, you guys are better than me. Okay. And he begs them not to leave, to come in, wash their feet, and rest under the tree while he goes and makes them a meal, basically.
It's interesting you say that, because there's also a type of hospitality that like shows largesse that can be the exact opposite of that. Like, people think they're being very hospitable, but they're actually really just trying to
show off
themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the exact opposite of that type.
It's coming from true humility.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, who is Abraham? Is he poor or rich?
He's rich.
He's rich. He's got 300 servants. Remember that. 300 fighting men when he goes out later to save Lot. Who knows how many servants? Younger ones who don't fight yet. Boy servants, girl servants. So, and it says like when he moves, he's heavy with stuff, with possessions. Okay, so this is no little person. And for him to bow down, that is showing an attitude of the heart, that even though he has all this stuff, he's acting as if he is on a lower social economic scale than these strangers, who, if they're three people, we don't hear of them coming with a whole load of cargo, and it's not a whole caravan according to what's mentioned in the text. So already he's got this humility, and he begs them to come eat with him. And you know, first eat with me, since after all, you have stopped by your servant's place. The only reason he's offering this hospitality is that they happen to be going by. They're not his friends. There's nothing about them that commends them or that makes them deserve it. So they agree. And then what does Abraham do next? Okay, but before... Oh, no, that's what he says he's going to do, which it's implied that he does. You're right. But then, let's see, what verse am I thinking about? Verse 6. His first action. What's the verb used?
He hurries.
Okay, so he hurries to the tent to Sarah, and he says, quick, take 3 se'im of flour and knead it and make cakes. Okay, she's going to make a meal from scratch, so she better hurry because it's going to take a while.
For bread and rice.
That's right. Or, I mean, maybe they're not going to be all the way risen. Maybe something like a Druze bread or a pita. Then what's the next thing? Verse 7.
He runs.
Okay, Abraham runs. And what does he get? A soft son of a cow. Soft and good. Okay. So he's not just taking a goat. And a goat would be good enough. I mean, because people don't eat meat every day, right? A goat is often a gift. Samson brings a goat to make amends with his wife. When I was in southern Sudan and I was the guest, I remember them slaughtering a goat for us. And we had goat stew. And thinking, you know, they don't know me. And here they have spared a whole goat just because we came.
They have not spared a goat.
Sorry, that's what I meant. Thanks. They have not spared a whole goat just for me. So a goat would have been good enough. But he gets... A satin calf. That's a lot of meat.
He's rich, though.
He is rich. True. So you could say it was easier for him. But again, these are for just random strangers. He doesn't know them.
In Israel, that's about 700 shekels. You would play.
700 shekels.
A Bedouin sells his goat to the market at around 700 shekels.
A Bedouin sells a goat for 700 shekels. How much does a Bedouin sell a fattened calf?
I don't know.
Much more.
Oh, yeah, way more.
Okay, and here's the next question. If Abraham has 300 servants, why is he running out to choose the calf?
He wants the best one.
He wants the best one, yeah.
He's going to his wine cellar.
Yeah, maybe. And I would say he is another sign of him being the host. Like, he doesn't just leave it for a service to decide. He wants to be sure that this is the best one. He's going out of his way. That's my point.
And the same thing with Sarah. It would be typical for him to, again, yeah, not have servants to cook.
Right. But they're doing it themselves with their own hands, even though they could have, you know, just taken something out of the freezer and popped it in the microwave. They're making a meal from scratch. And this is to show their respect for the people coming. Of course, I'm not being literal in my metaphor. And he hurries. Again, he hurries to prepare it. And then he takes butter and milk and this calf and he prepares it. Okay, so butter, again, a sign of richness, creaminess. These are valued things in the world. So in our day and age, I don't know, maybe it's like steak and a fine wine. Can you imagine going out to the street and just asking three people in and preparing them a steak dinner with wine, a nice wine? I mean, seriously.
If I were in another situation where I weren't in a big city, but like a small village and some were coming through, maybe.
Maybe?
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I save steak dinners for like birthdays.
Right.
I can't imagine, or like some special event, to just, especially in this country where meat, beef is not cheap.
Or lamb chops.
Or lamb chops, they're not cheap.
Cheaper now than they were before.
Cheaper now than they were before. Yeah, so it's even more of a precedent. And notice, it says, Vehu omed alehem. He's standing by them with a towel. Doesn't say with a towel. He is the butler. As they're eating, he's standing to wait on them. So again, not only are they eating with him, but he's literally serving them. And they ate. Okay, and then begins their whole discussion with him. Where is Sarah, your wife? And all of this. So why does the Bible go out of its way to give this lengthy description of Abraham preparing this stuff? It didn't have to say that. It could have just said, and Abraham prepared food for them. It goes out of its way to show us how Abraham went out of his way. It is communicating the value of hospitality, and it's showing you Abraham's character. Again, in biblical stories, we seldom have statements of he was a generous person. Instead, they show you by verbs, by what they're actually doing. And you notice repeatedly in this section how he's run. He's hurried to do his best. He's given them not just what common courtesy would do, not just a glass of water and a bit of pita, but, you know, slaughtering the calf, bringing out the good hem'ah, the good butter. All right, we could contrast this to Lot, his nephew, who is not quite as generous.
But he's pretty generous.
But he's normal. Lot, I would say, is normal. If you read in chapter 19... Remember when the two angels come to Sodom in the next chapter?
Why is there only two instead of three?
That's a good question. Why two instead of three? We'll ponder that one. So look at verse 1 in chapter 19. The two angels come to Sodom at night, and Lot's sitting at the gate. Okay, so far so good, right? He's sitting out in front like Abraham. You could say waiting for passers-by. And Lot sees him. And he gets up towards them. That's interesting. So he stands up. Whereas Abraham ran out to meet them, Lot stands up. So I would say again, Lot is showing a normal person's hospitality, and Abraham is showing like super host.
But he still bows to them.
He does.
You could argue that he lives in a city. Abraham did.
And Abraham didn't live in the city.
Yeah. City people are different.
City people are different, yeah.
Also, if you're in the country, you might have to run to get someone's attention. They're not going to come to the city gate.
That's right.
If they're walking by, you might have to get somehow.
We're all arguing in Lot's favor. That maybe he is as hospitable as Abraham after all. He bows down. He's in the city gate. And he does say, "Sir, turn in." And again, it's, oh no, there's Adonai. "Sirs, turn into the house of your servant and stay the night and wash your feet and get up and go on your way." Okay, it's getting dark, right? It said it was evening time. And if we took out electricity from our lives, we all realize you can't travel at night, right? At night, there's bandits, it's hard. You need to sleep somewhere. So what is the ancient hotel? It's people's houses. So Lot's inviting him in, making sure that they have a place to stay. And they say, no, we'll sleep out in the open square. And look at verse 3. What does Lot do? He insists. He really insists. And so they came to him. So he has learned something from Abram, right? Because he's insisting.
Yeah, but he also knew that it would be dangerous outside.
He knew that it would be dangerous outside.
It's something that he really cares, you know.
Right.
He's in a city. It's not his responsibility.
He's in the city, it's not his responsibility, and he cares. Someone's brought up that he knew it would be dangerous. Why would it be dangerous?
Well, we can see that in the continuation.
We can see that in the continuation. And I think we're being influenced a little bit from later. If you look at 2 Peter 2, 6-8. We're talking about Sodom and Gomorrah. "If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials." So Lot, according to 2 Peter, he lived among them. He chose to live there, remember. But he was distressed by their evil. And so he knew it would be dangerous out in the street. Now, here's the bigger question. What is their evil? What is Sodom's sin? And let's read two places from Genesis just to fill us in on what we've been told in the Bible so far, if you were just reading it like one big story. Okay, so Genesis 13:13. What does it tell us?
Ve'anshei Sodom ra'im v'hata'im l'Adonai me'od.
The people of Sodom were very bad and sinners against God very much.
Just as a side note, in literal punditry, you always read that the Christian and the Jewish answer to your question is what distinguishes Jews from Christians.
Yeah. Okay. That might be true. And we'll lay out the options in a second. Genesis 18:20, further on in our same chapter that we started reading.
ויאמר אדוני זעקת סדום ועמורה כי רבה וחטאתם כי חבדה מאוד.
Okay, so the scream or the cry from Sodom is big and their sin is very heavy.
It sounds a little bit like Nineveh.
Sounds a little like Nineveh, yeah. They're also sinners. And if you read
it, says
in,
that it goes up.
Their sin goes up before God. And the king calls them to change their wicked ways and the Hamas, the violence that's in their hand. And if you actually trace the word Hamas, it can be used in the context of economic oppression as well, which is a form of violence if you think about it. Okay, so two passages, they're not too detailed.
No.
So people throughout history connected to the Bible have tried to interpret what the sin might be. And
starting with the prophets.
You're right. Of course, the famous, what do we have the word sodomy in English? Is
sodomy.
Is sodomy. It's a sexual sin, a specific one, where a man sleeps with a man, right? That's what the word means in English today.
Sodomy.
And that comes from this story where the strangers, the all the people of the town, from young to old, want to come sleep with these strangers.
Just another side note. In Arabic, a sodomite is called a luti.
That's right.
One shows you see him.
That's more slang.
We got some.
Sexual perversion is the director, Shazjitsiyan. But for slang, you can see a luti, a person like Lot. Although Lot, of course, is not a slang.
Luti, in Arabic slang, please don't repeat that, means like Lot, and it's a sexual sin. And there's some other words there for sexual sin in general. And two interpretations throughout history have been that. One is specifically men sleeping with men, and the other one is just sexual sin in general. Immorality could include adultery, fornication, anything else that fits into that category.
They may have been referring to Lot sleeping with the daughters.
And Lot sleeping with his own daughters.
It means male.
Later.
Sex between men.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because the cultures of the day, and even later, they didn't prescribe that kind of behavior. And in Greek,
In the Greek world,
it was something about, it was something unique to Jewish civilization, which says male homosexual sex is wrong.
Right. So,
there's another thing.
But I want to point out while we're talking about this one interpretation of sodomy being men sleeping with men, I want to point out that you cannot say this is being gay, because certainly not every single person from young to old in the city was gay. This is not an act of, I'm just sexually oriented this way, blah, blah, blah. This is an act of
violence,
of assault. And what is the point? Is to shame the guests. This is, if Abraham is the ultimate hospitality, this is the ultimate unhospitality. Not only are you not taking care of their needs, but you are shaming them in the worst way possible.
Publicly.
Yeah, publicly. So we're not dealing here about lifestyles and all of that stuff. This is just ordinary people trying to shame
it's like
other people.
What happens in a jail when there's somebody who's not.
What happens in a jail? There you go.
How they make that person.
It's a pecking order.
Follow the rest of the hierarchy.
Yeah, there's a hierarchy.
They'll corner one person off, a bunch of them, and sodomize that person, and then that person is put in their place.
That person is certainly broken. Yes.
Another thing, by the way, is the connection with chapter 18, and that is from the Noah story, because there's so many things that connect the stories.
Uh-huh.
And there, because there's nothing really, particular that said about Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. You could grab things as the first one is the paradigmatic one. There's so many chapters that are spent on the known and fled. And there it just says that every thought of their heart was bad.
Every thought of their heart was bad, like this general evil.
Yeah.
And you could say, if you look at Jeremiah 23:14, there are people, the sin of Sodom, by the way, there's been whole dissertations written on it. So I'm just giving snippets here because we don't have that much time.
Jeremiah 23:14.
Now Jeremiah is attacking the prophets of Jerusalem, okay? And he says, but in the prophets of Jerusalem, I have seen a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen the hands of evildoers so that no one turns from his evil. All of them have become like Sodom to me, and its inhabitants like Gomorrah. And so God's going to feed them bitter food and poisoned water. All right, if I were a Jerusalem prophet, I wouldn't be feeling too good about now being compared to Sodom. But what are the sins of Sodom that Jeremiah points to?
Adultery.
Adultery is one of them, okay. So that's in the sexual sin category.
Lies.
Lies. Deceit.
23:4.
They're dealing falsely. What did you say?
23:14.
Strengthening the hands of evildoers. Maybe if you know people are cheating on their taxes, but you don't go and demand them to do the right thing. That would be strengthening their hands. There's a lot of subtle things that could be going on here.
Or if someone's accused in court and you sort of don't...
Accused in court, you don't stand up and defend the right side. And what's the result of this? No one turns from evil. Then there's no repentance. And this is like Sodom. Okay, so it's a much broader thing than men sleeping with men. It's evil. There's evil of what they've done and what they've left undone. As the Christian confession in liturgy says, we've sinned against you by what we've done and by what we've left undone.
You can see this in certain countries where justice isn't done, or there's an attitude that...
In countries where justice isn't upheld and there's an attitude, it leads to exactly this.
Where anything goes.
Anything goes, there tends to be corruption, and no one's stopping it, and no one turns from their evil.
Someone was telling us this week about a country they live in that everybody steals from the country. And so when the president gets elected,
the president steals as well.
Yeah, except the president steals more.
It's expected that, people will steal if they can. Yeah.
And so all the people themselves steal as well, even if they can only steal a little.
All the people steal to whatever capacity they can. Yeah, we're dealing with these things. If the leaders do a certain thing, then the people follow. Okay, so again, we have a broad definition of the sin of Sodom. And if you look at extra-biblical literature, you also have in the testament of Naphtali, Benjamin, and Levi, that it's sexual impurity in general. Okay, but now let's look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel 16, verses 49 to 50. Ezekiel, did I say 16? Yeah, 16. Sorry, I'm slow on the thumb today. 16:49 to 50. Here, this was the iniquity of Sodom, your sister. Okay, you ready? Pride. Being full
of food,
of lechem. and being complacent. Okay, that's a little different than our standard interpretation.
I have the Hebrew in front of me. The English here is in the singular. It's actually listing, and it should say, it should be, these are the sins. Because it, then it lists in 49 and 50.
Right, they list a couple.
Yes, avon sdom.
Avon.
This is the sin.
Would be the plural.
Avonot.
Yeah. Avonot.
Yeah. But maybe.
Would be a plural?
Yeah.
Yeah, he could be looking at it as one big lump. You could also argue maybe he's associating these sins together. Mm. And I think that there's something in that argument. Because look, I'll read it for you in Hebrew for those who care. Hine, ze haya avon sdom achotech, gaon, sivat lechem, veshalvat hashaket, hayala, ulivnoteha, veyad ani veevion, lo hehezika. Okay. Now we get the opposite statement of what we had in Jeremiah.
Actually, you didn't finish. Oh, okay. Verse 50. They were haughty and did detestable things before me.
Vatigbehena v'ta'asena to'eva lefanai. V'asir ethen ka'asher ra'iti.
To'eva. To'eva is the Hebrew word for detestable.
Detestable, abomination, that's
and
right.
That's what you would, and that's the word, to'eva is the word that's used also in Leviticus 18. Where
that's right. Where men sleep together is also referred to with this word, to'eva.
It's not exclusively used there, but to'eva, when they talk about a male homosexual sex, they use the
to'eva. True, but the big point is to'eva is not only for male sex, it's for other, it's for all kinds of, any way that you...
Yeah.
But it is a serious sin.
As well as
it's a detestable sin that they have done. But notice the linkage here. They're prideful, and they're full of food, and they're complacent. So being full of food is not a bad thing, right?
But
being motivated by pride and then complacent, when you have all this stuff and then you leave the poor with nothing, that's the sin. Now think back with me, when Lot chose to live in Sodom and Gomorrah, why did he choose to go there?
It looks really nice.
Green.
It was compared to the garden of the Lord. It was green and lush. Okay, now look around this land today. Green spots are desirable, right? There's not a lot of water other places. It's harder to live other places. Lot wanted an easy life, and in that spot there was abundance. That means the people were rich. They were sitting around. It's green. They had all the food they could ever want. They are full and satisfied. And yet, the problem is that the poor and the Evyon, who's in a poor social status, they didn't help. In all their abundance, they didn't help. Okay.
Now, is this a tradition that's being passed on that wasn't in Genesis that Ezekiel knows, or is he going metaphorical on what Sodom and Gomorrah means for him and the people in his day, or what was happening
there? It would have to be, because he was not a contemporary. He's talking about something he would
eat. Ezekiel's not a contemporary, that's
sure,
right.
But there could be some tradition that wasn't recorded in Genesis that was passed down with those stories, right?
All of the traditions going on, all of our interpretation up to the present day, comes from the fact that when you read the stories, the original stories in Genesis, you have to read between the lines because they're very vague. And so you have to come up what is really going on in this story.
No, but there is a possibility that there's another tradition that Genesis doesn't write about.
Sure.
That Ezekiel has.
Sure, there could be. But I argue that it's enough, the tradition we have is enough to arrive at Ezekiel's conclusion.
Based on Genesis
18 and 19.
But not the poorness, the complacency and all that I can see, but I can't see that the Ani Vedevion.
Okay, I'll tell you why. In any society, there's poor, there's widows and orphans. That's obviously the disenfranchised, the people you need to be helping. And who else is in that category? The strangers. Okay, so you go back to Genesis 18, the strangers. And they're sitting in the gate.
Those three are always...
Also.
Why are the strangers sitting in the gate? Well, because no one's invited them inside. Right? So this is inhospitality. Even though everybody's well off, they all have their yachts and whatever, no one is going out and simply helping the person who's homeless.
also Zakah, where it says the yells come up to the Lord.
Zakah is connected specifically.
It's almost like 90-95% how you do it before.
Gary's giving the 99.5%. Zakah is a cry of distress that comes from the poor, the widow, the orphan, the disenfranchised in your society.
When Zakah is used where?
Anywhere in the Bible. It tends to be coming from people in the poor. It's used
in Genesis 18.
In Genesis 18, when it was talking, when we read about Sodom's sin.
Oh, okay.
So according to Ezekiel, the sin of Sodom is pride and not helping the poor people. Out of your abundance, you don't even do regular hospitality. Okay.
What would you say, though, in verse 50, that it said, and detestable things?
And detestable things. Well, I'm saying, back to your... Right, Tova. If you look at the Greek culture as well, the Roman culture. You know where they have these big feasts and they binge and then they go throw up so they can eat some more? What a waste of food. You could have given that food to somebody else who didn't have any. You know what I'm saying? Like the two can lead, it can be a trajectory. And also in Greek society, what happened? They sit around, they got drunk, and then they start experimenting in all sorts of sexual stuff.
But what's it going to do with Ezekiel?
So here in Ezekiel, it simply doesn't say.
It says detestable things.
But clearly the text in Genesis does say they were having homosexual sex with these strangers.
Right. It does. And so Ezekiel, I'm saying the Torah Va would be inclusive of also any kind of sexual sin.
Right. Because it doesn't say specifically.
Including all of it. All of the Torah books.
Also, Yeshua doesn't talk about homosexuality, but it doesn't mean that he's saying it's not he never mentions it. So Ezekiel, the fact that Ezekiel doesn't mention it.
Right, but he does say a man or a
woman. The reason I'm not wanting to talk about homosexuality this morning is because that's a big, fat, sticky issue. But because that's kind of been the assumed argument of Christianity, and I want to show...
That's the exclusive.
Exclusively, yeah. Now I want to show that it's so much more because I'm not homosexual, and if we just chalk it all up to that, then it doesn't. There's nothing in it for me. But if I realize that it's actually talking about pride and not helping the poor, that's something I can relate to. And
that. We don't want to be involved in eisegesis here. I mean, if we're not going to take the plain meaning.
We want plain meaning of the text.
No, but that's not why you interpret it that way. That's the reading of the text.
I'm not reading into it. I'm reading the verse in Jeremiah that says pride. That's the first thing. Gaon.
Ezekiel.
Exactly.
We've already agreed neither Ezekiel or Jeremiah were contemporaries.
Sure.
Of what we just read about in Genesis. So they're free to speculate and say, well,
they are.
In addition,
and they're also in our canon.
In addition to wanting to rape three strangers, they were also overfed, they were hospitable. It's all true. And nothing is wrong. But neither Jeremiah or Ezekiel were contemporaries. We agree with that. And secondly, we don't want to violate the plain meaning of the scripture.
No.
It's not just Christian tradition reading into it. The Jews themselves were the first civilization to stand up and say that male homosexuality is wrong.
That's
the
fine.
The Inuit culture, that's you can, say it's not wrong.
That's fine. Male
the
sexuality.
Culture says it's not wrong.
She's saying it has both meanings.
Yeah, but let's not avoid the plain meaning of the text. If we want to talk about nuance, that's okay. But it's not about being inhospitable.
In Genesis 18, it is definitely about being inhospitable.
No, that's not the main reason. It's not that they didn't show Kabbalah Panim, Zarim. This is not the main
reason. Are you arguing that every single person in Sodom is a homosexual?
I don't think the text is saying every person.
It says from the least to the greatest came around. Plain meaning of the text. Least to the greatest came around their house asking to sleep with the guest.
I'm disagreeing. I'm saying... That doesn't literally mean every person in the city. That's all.
I thought you wanted the plain meaning of the text.
Well, Jesus, look, God says that he'll cover some of his wings, but he's not a big chicken. In other words, you've got to show some common sense when you approach the text.
Exactly.
When it says every person, it doesn't literally mean every person in the city. That's all I'm saying.
I agree with you there. But the point is that it's not saying that those sexually oriented to desire to sleep with a man encircled his house. It's just regular people from the city came. So their motive is not because of their sexual orientation, it's simply to screw the strangers, basically. And I'm using coarse language because our prophets did to make a point. That's their point, to be rude and to hurt the stranger.
Because there are many examples of where people are inhospitable in the Old Testament. What's unique about this text
is that they take it out sexually.
Yes.
And my point is that they've taken it to that extreme. That not only are they standardly inhospitable, but they are egregiously inhospitable.
Because the story in Judges, it wasn't homosexual sex. It was actually heterosexual, but with this one woman. But it was just as bad. Because it was inhospitable, it was rape.
Yeah, like, there's no homosexual.
There's no mutual consent in this at all, you know.
In the Judges, the chapter in Judges, there's absolutely no homosexual. It has nothing to do with homosexuality.
Right.
But this plainly does.
There are plenty of references in the Old Testament where you can point to homosexual being an abomination. That's fine. That's obvious, right?
Also, you can say in Leviticus 18, where it talks about all the sexual relations that are proceeding, you can say, well, you know, I can't really remember because I'm not attracted to having sex with beasts. I'm not attracted to having sex, same sex. Not all of it applies to you. All of it applies to you. So it's fine, I think, to look at shades of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not miss the main point here, that there is homosexual...
If you read Genesis 18 and 19, you are reading into the text when you say it's about homosexuality. But Genesis 18 and 19 does not say it's about homosexuality. It just says that they came to rape those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's eisegesis as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a broader rape going on.
And the fact that it's a hot button issue in our society shouldn't be here or there. We should let the scripture speak, you know,
let
plainly.
The scripture speak.
We know it's our values are incompatible with more and more with our own culture, with
mm-hmm.
our Western culture. We know that. So there's a tension to always be a tension now. We're not living in the 1950s and 60s where there was consensus. I mean, we're redefining marriage.
Right.
So there's going to be this tension. So it's, as you say, sticky. We can't avoid that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in avoiding the unpleasantness and the stickiness, we can't do, you know, we need to let the cookie go.
If I give a sermon on love, am I avoiding the issue of faithfulness or the issue of truth or anything else? No, I'm simply directing our thoughts on a certain topic. And we came to this text in Genesis 18, because Abraham is the father of hospitality. We moved on to Lot because in many ways he resembles Abraham, although not quite as hospitable. Then we dealt with the issue of Sodom, what the sin is, and we showed how in the scripture it's broad, including sexual sins, not limited to male with male. Other places...
Yeah. By the way, something popped in my mind. The fact that we've used the word Sodom.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we don't call somebody that's inhospitable or haughty or overeats. We don't call that person a Sodom.
But that's
you're right,
very,
and
I mean,
that's because of our interpretation.
It doesn't mean that it's not in that text, that they were not inhospitable. You know, that's very true. But
mm-hmm.
the fact is that we use that. It's not even a euphemism. I'd say that is the term for it. I mean,
in English, yes, sodomy means homosexual relations.
You could use other technical jargon for it, but essentially Sodom, the word Sodom, is not about inhospitality.
Of course not. Not today. But you're mixing two things.
That's an argument from etymology.
Yeah.
Not at all. Not at all. It's an argument from this story.
Okay. Listen, back to Ezekiel. Stop. Stop. I don't want to talk about the etymology of the word sodomy. It's an English word. It comes from the story. We were talking about the story.
It comes from the story.
I have 5 minutes, and what I want to give you guys is a takeaway message for you. It's not for all those people out there. It's for you. Are you gay?
No, that's not the point.
Okay, then, no, it is my point.
It is my point. I'm talking about the story. What is the story about? It's not just about being haughty and inhospitable and
glamorous. It's not just, but it certainly includes that.
But the main issue is here, and that's why it's proof text.
The main issue can be argued. I want to look at Matthew 10.
Where are you at?
I'm at Matthew 10. And we're going to read from some red letters. Too bad our friends left us right before we hear Jesus' take on this. Okay.
Matthew what?
Matthew 10, 14 to 15. This is when Jesus is sending out the 12 apostles, right? And he's saying, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and say that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. You received without paying, give without pay. Acquire no gold, nor silver, nor copper for your belt. Sorry, I'm back a few verses. No bag for your journey, nor two tunics, nor sandals, nor a staff, for the laborer deserves his food. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it, and stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, read it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. Number 14, and if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or town. Truly, I say to you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. So in this passage, not receiving the traveling teacher and showing him hospitality and his disciples is equated with Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, they're in the same category. Very clearly. Now, you could argue that Sodom and Gomorrah is also brought up because they're the epitome of sin in people's minds, but the literal connection there has to do with hospitality. And if we...
That they didn't receive Jesus.
Well, that they didn't receive the disciples, because this isn't Jesus himself. He's sending out apostles to say that the kingdom of heaven is coming right now. Which for him begins now and carries out into eternity, of course. So, you could say in Jesus' day there's already a culture where, you know, there's these traveling rabbis, and Jesus himself goes from house to house. You know, he doesn't have his own homestead. He doesn't support himself. He relies on other people. But he is expecting that same attitude towards other people in villages where they're going to go. And so that's what I find challenging in my life. If Jesus' disciples came by my house, what would I have done? Would I have put them up? Would I have said, hey, you can come in, I don't have a guest room, you can sleep on the couch, or you can sleep in my room? And that leads us back to Abraham running out and trying to bring in the guests. I want to also read from Avot 5:10. Let me just get there. In Avot 5:10, you have the phrase, what is mine is four types I think it's in a disciple, but it could just be in people in general. What is mine is mine, and what is yours. And then, wait.
What is yours is mine.
Yeah, I don't have all four of them, unfortunately, because I took the shortcut from his book.
Just read it.
But here, what is mine, and what is yours. That is, who is unwilling to be generous. And then, later on, what is yours is mine, and what is mine is mine, and what is yours is mine. This is the disposition, or the characteristic of Sodom. So again, this not only are you not helping, but you're actually taking advantage of the stranger and the poor and the people who are disenfranchised, and
you're financially raping them.
You're financially raping them. You could be physically raping them. It's all part of the same category of what's in your heart. You're taking advantage of them. And there was one other scripture that I really wanted us to read. It's yeah, just our Hebrews. Well, in Hebrews 13:2. Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you also are in the body. And look at verse 4 is a nice little link if you want to connect back to the sexual impropriety. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So Hebrews here is even combining the two things together. But to me, at the end of Sukkot, I think this is the challenge for all of us. Do we have the same attitude of Abraham in us, and that Jesus is condoning here, of just welcoming in a complete stranger who can never repay us? Welcoming them in, eating with them, because if you're eating together, you're already by default trusting the person. Not to poison your food, you're already giving them respect of saying, your life is as valuable as my life. And do we show that kind of respect? And that was certainly one of the things severely lacking in the city of Sodom, and one of the things noted to be lacking through the prophets. Another little quote I found interesting in Clement, if you read 1 Clement 11:1, Lot's being saved from Sodom is chalked up to his hospitality and piety, those two things together. Because of his hospitality and piety, Lot was saved from Sodom. So I want us to leave this morning with that object in mind of doing what we see Abraham do. And Jesus says he does what he sees the Father doing. When I took a drama class, I remember we all stood in a circle, and we were all told to look at the opposite person and do what they do. And there was the drama teacher, and he starts to raise his hand like this. So the person across from the circle does that. And so you're standing there, and you see that, and you do that. And so the whole circle is simultaneously raising their arm, because they're all looking. And that just, I was reminded of that. Like when we're looking at Jesus, and Jesus throughout the Gospel of John keeps saying, I do as the Father is doing, I do as the Father is doing. And he's sitting down, eating, he's being hosted, he's sitting with sinners, he's inviting himself over to eat, and you see this, all these traits. And if we're copying Jesus, and Jesus is showing the Father, then not only are we in unity, but we are in unity with God and his value, because God is generous. And even, interestingly, in Sukkot, even non-Jews are welcomed into the Sukkah tent.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a really nice picture for us as Christians, because within the believers' church, there's debate about, you know, Jew, non-Jew, and all of that. And here we see complete unity, and we're both dependent on God being in the Sukkah. So, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Be generous.
Thank you. Be hospitable.
Be hospitable.
Paul talks about